Welcome to this BGSM podcast. My name's William Winterby. I'm a sport and exercise medicine consultant in the UK, and I'm part of the team redesigning the Physical Activity Clinical Champions Programme in England. The Physical Activity Clinical Champions Programme, or PAC Programme, is a national project delivering physical activity education to professionals working in healthcare to help get patients more physically active. It was previously led by Public Health England, but the redesign has been taken on by the Faculty of Sport and Exercise Medicine, the Advanced Wellbeing Research Centre at Sheffield Hallam University, and Intelligent Health. As part of this, we're delivering a podcast series in collaboration with the BGSM around physical activity. For anyone that'd like to get involved with the PAC programme, please do get in touch with us. The email address is pac@shu.ac.uk. That's pacc@shu.ac.uk. Now, without further ado, I'd like to introduce our speaker for today. We've got Dr. Tim Anstis, who's a real expert in all things around motivational interview and behaviour change. Tim, would you be able to introduce yourself to the listeners today?
Sure, and thanks for having me on, Will. So, yeah, medical doctor, studied at Southampton, had a year off, did sports medicine in the States, but quite early on recognised I was kind of more interested really in prevention than treatment. Did a bit of work in psychiatry, then was for 10 years the occupational health doctor at Ealing Hospital and the West London Mental Health Care Trust, and got my hands on an old gym, and we fit it out with a fitness centre, and we developed a sort of centre for staff, but also patients, and we did cardiac rehab and chronic pain. So always really been interested in behaviour change and exercise and rehab. Then made a transition into academia at Thames Valley University, developed an MSc in exercise and lifestyle medicine. And then a lot of my career I've spent, you know, training and encouraging healthcare professionals to get better at health coaching, really. And I've been involved in a few initiatives, including the Let's Get Moving physical activity care pathway back in the day, and more recently been delighted to be working with the faculty on their moving medicine initiative.
Well, thanks so much for coming on today. It's really great to have you here. What I want to dive into is, as part of this program we've been developing, the Physical Activity Clinical Champions program, we've undertaken lots of meetings with a wide range of different healthcare professionals, including GPs, nurses, physiotherapists, secondary care doctors, social prescribers, and lots of different people working within the healthcare setting. And a lot of them have talked about the fantastic benefits of physical activity for different conditions, and they've been gaining more and more knowledge in that area over the recent years. But one area that a lot of people felt there was a lack of understanding was about specific practical skills that they could have to improve their conversations with patients around physical activity. So I wanted to kick off today really asking around what do you see as some of the common traps or mistakes that us as healthcare professionals sometimes make when we're talking to patients in clinic about physical activity?
Well, that's a great question. And some of it stems from having a background as a clinician. Your mindset can be around finding out what's wrong with the person, trying to fix it. And so if you carry that mindset in the conversations about physical activity, you know, you're trying to find out what's wrong with the patient and fix it. Whereas it's much better really to adopt a person-centered conversational style, trying to draw out from the person their own reasons for change. And so some of the common traps clinicians and others can fall into is over-assessing. So over-assessing someone, let's say at the start of a conversation, can get them on the back foot a bit, can help them feel a bit judged. So over-assessing is a common trap. Many people on this, you know, listening to this may recognise what we call the yes but trap. Well, could you do this? Yes but. But what about this? Yes but. Well, have you thought about this? Yes but. So jumping in with single bits of unasked for advice can get into a bit of a trap, and there's an antidote to that approach. Sometimes we overestimate, or clinicians can overestimate, how ready the person is to change, and they rush into planning with goal setting and exploring barriers. That can stop the conversation progressing nicely. And sometimes we can fall into the expert trap. We just jump in and tell people what they should be doing and how they should be doing it, rather than staying in a kind of person-centered conversational style.
Brilliant. Thanks very much. Well, I think that's really, really helpful to highlight those different things that can go wrong. I know you're a big fan of motivational interviewing and using that within conversations with patients. I just wanted to ask you to give us an understanding of what motivational interviewing is, where does it come from, and how do we think it works?
Thanks. Yeah, I heard about MI when I was working in as an occupational health doctor and got trained in it. And it's not a great name for the approach, but it had its origins in the drug and alcohol field in America, where the approach was commonly to confront someone with, let's say, a drinking problem. Look, your drinking's causing you liver damage, you've lost your job, you've lost your partner. And understandably, when you confronted people, they would get defensive and we'd say, oh, they're in denial. And what Bill Miller did is he used just a person-centered humanistic counseling approach with people in drug and alcohol settings. And what he noticed is, spontaneously, people would come out with what he called self-motivating statements. They would say, well, I'd like to, I want to, I know I should, you know, I used to be able to. And so what he recognised is when you stop trying to persuade people to change and give them space to think and talk in a non-judgmental climate, they may spontaneously come out with their own reasons and motivations, which could be strengthened by the clinician or the practitioner as the conversation progressed. And subsequent work, we now relabel self-motivating statement as change talk. So it had its origins in the drug and alcohol field, but it's spread really widely now into mental health and offending and social work and management. So it's a nice conversational style to help people change and grow.
And how would you say it differs from other types of behavior change theory, like cognitive behavioral therapy?
One of the core concepts in motivational interviewing is this psychological state known as ambivalence, having mixed feelings about change, both wanting to change and not wanting to change. And this is really common and it's not pathological. People are ambivalent about losing weight, stopping drinking, changing their job, asking someone for a date. So ambivalence is really common. And MI tends to focus on helping someone explore their mixed feelings about change and maybe resolve their ambivalence. And on the journey from not changing to changing, people must go through the stage of ambivalence. Now with CBT, it tends to be a bit of a skills-based approach, you know, helping people become more aware of cognitive errors and underlying assumptions and unhelpful beliefs and thinking traps. And so you're trying in a way to help them develop particular thinking skills. And we know this can be helpful. MI is not about developing someone's skills. It's more about helping them come to a decision about whether they want to change and then exploring how they might best go about it.
Brilliant. And you mentioned kind of people at different stages of change. How might you approach people differently if they're at kind of different stages of change, and what are those different stages?
Yeah, so work done quite a long time ago, the kind of trans-theoretical or stages of change model, identified people as passing from, let's say, pre-contemplation, where they're not thinking about change, whether it's physical activity, diet, stopping drinking, stopping smoking. Contemplation is where they're thinking about it, but they haven't decided to change. And that's when they're in this state I mentioned earlier called ambivalence. Then they may move to preparation and action, where they're actually taking steps towards behaviour change. And then maybe they go to maintenance, where they're maintaining the change. And you would probably have slightly different conversations, or you would ideally have different conversations, depending on where you judge the person might be. So if they're not thinking about becoming more active, then your task might be just to raise the subject without triggering defensiveness, and maybe explore the pros and cons in their own mind for becoming more active. If they are in contemplation, they've been thinking about it, again, help them explore their mixed feelings and maybe strengthen through conversation their own reasons for change and their own confidence about becoming more active if they chose to. And then they may make a transition to preparation, in which case stay in this evoking mode, don't jump into creating the plan for them, and draw out from them their own ideas about being successful. And then if they're active and they're maintaining it, then you might be, you know, just ask them about how it's going, what are they noticing, what might get in the way of the plan. So there are different behavior change techniques you might use according to where you estimate the person to be in terms of their readiness to change.
That's really interesting. And I think, you know, I know there's a important relationship between motivation and confidence when we're thinking about someone's readiness to change. And I was just wondering if you could expand a little bit on that and those concepts.
Yeah, you're entirely right, Will. So someone might really, really want to change, but they don't believe they can. In which case, you may want to talk to them in a way which strengthens their confidence or self-efficacy for making and sustaining the behaviour change. And then, you know, there's also people who absolutely could become more active if they chose to, but they're just not motivated. And you might have a different conversation with those people. And there's two techniques I commonly train in which, you know, and these come from solution-focused therapy or coaching. So you might use scaling questions. So you might ask someone, I'm just wondering, on a scale of 0 to 10, how important is it for you to become more active? 0 is not at all important. 10 is very important. They'll give you a number. It could be 3. It could be 8. The number doesn't really matter because you're asking the question in order to ask the next question. Let's say they said 3. Why 3? You could have said 0 or 1. What are some of the reasons you have for becoming more active? And you're asking that to evoke from them their own ideas and reasons for change. It doesn't matter how many reasons I've got for someone to move more. What matters is how many reasons they've got. And the more I jump in and try to persuade someone to change, that's going to get in the way of them surfacing. So what we're trying to do in MI is get the person to talk themselves into changing. But if someone really wants to change and they don't believe they can, then we might use the confidence scaling question and say, and let's say you did decide to change. I'm just wondering, on a scale of 0 to 10, when 0 is not at all confident and 10 is very confident, how confident are you? You could become more active and maybe keep it up for 10 weeks. And let's say they said 1 or 2. You could say, well, why 1 or 2? You could have said 0. What are some of the reasons you believe you could become more active if you chose to? And fish and draw out from them the reasons why they believe they could. And then you're not going to say, what's stopping you becoming more confident? Is this a solution-focused approach? You're going to say, I'm just wondering, what might help increase your confidence? Perhaps to a 4 or a 5, see what they say. And then at that stage, you could share with them politely, can I share with you a couple of things other patients tell me they find helpful? And then share with them a few things and say, what do you make of what I've just said? So slightly different coaching techniques according to whether or not you're trying to build up perceived importance in the patient's mind for moving more, or their self-efficacy and confidence that they could move more if they decided to.
Brilliant. And what are, you know, are there some other key skills or techniques that you think can be helpful that our clinicians could learn from and use within their consultations?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, there's a big overlap here with just being a good clinician anyway and listening to patients and being person-centered and patient-centric. And people talk about this transition, don't they, between talking about what's the matter with the person towards what matters to them and kind of values-driven healthcare. So there's some core, we call them micro skills in MI, but they're generic skills. There's asking good open questions, not just closed questions, getting the person talking. We talk about using your O's. So O is the open questions. A stands for affirmations. And these are noticing and commenting on what's right with the person. So they're not the same as compliments. They're not the same as praise. It's because you're kind of saying something specific. I can see you're moving more and better and more easily than the last time I saw you. Or you're taking your health really seriously. Or it's important for you to be a good mum. Your family's important to you. So you may recognise and affirm, you know, their values or their achievements or their strengths or the effort they're making. So we use the acronym VARS to identify things you might affirm. And then there's reflections. That's the R of ours. Empathic listening statements. Not asking a question, but saying something back to the person that helps them feel listened to, heard and understood, and then summaries where you're capturing some of the things they've said in the previous few minutes and bringing them back to check you've understood them. So those are the micro skills. And then in addition, there are some specific behaviour change techniques. I've mentioned a couple, importance and confidence scaling. But there's a wide range of these. There's, you know, decisional balance. I mean, some of you might have put a line down a sheet of paper. If you've come to a decision and written down the pros and cons of change, it's really just that technique with a patient, helping them look at the pros and cons of becoming more active. You could look at two possible futures. You know, let's imagine that you were to become more active and we met up in, you know, 6 months' time and you're living a healthy lifestyle. What might be different? And let's say you decided not to become more active when we met up in 6 months. What might be different? And if there is a difference, that can be motivating for the person. So these core skills of being patient-centered and then specific behavior change techniques. And that's one of the things I and other people like about motivational interviewing. There's this fusion, or there are these two aspects. You're paying a lot of attention to the relationship and relational factors, just as Carl Rogers did. Warmth, non-judgment, congruence, authenticity, etc. But you're also paying a lot of attention to using, in a stage-matched way, particular behaviour change techniques. And it's this combination as well which makes motivational interviewing perhaps slightly different from other behavioural approaches.
And it sounds, I mean, it sounds like it's a technique which is very focused on the patient or the person you're talking to, focused on what's important to them. But is there any kind of specific structure or key points to follow when you're going through this process? And if so, is there somewhere you can find out more about that?
Yeah, so in the second and third edition of the book, Bill Miller and Steve Rolnick called things various processes. In the recently published fourth edition of Motivation Interviewing, they talk about key tasks. First task is to engage. You're always working on engagement. Then there's focus. What's the conversation going to be about? And you know, we're here because the conversation is going to be about physical activity, but ideally the person would choose. Then there's evoking and drawing out from the person rather than putting in. And then there's planning. Hope you may not get to planning, because another trap, which I forgot to mention, I think, well, I might have mentioned rush to planning, but rushing to planning is a bit like if you try and pull away from stationary in third gear of a car. It kind of stalls. And if you don't go through getting engagement, focusing, evoking from the person their ideas and hopes and concerns, etc., before planning, then the conversation can be a bit challenged. And of course, this structure may depend on how much time you've got. So if you've only got a couple of minutes, you might just want to raise awareness and signpost and give a leaflet. If you've got longer, you might want to do importance and confidence scaling. And maybe if they're ready to change, make a transition to person-centered planning. And we've developed different conversations. If you go to the Moving Medicine website, there's, you know, how might you talk to someone if you've got a minute? And then there's like a 5 minute conversation, and then there's a more minutes conversation. So that's a great resource, both the Moving Medicine website and the Active Conversations course, which is on that site.
Brilliant. We'll make sure we've got the links to that linked in with the show. So within these in these consultations, I imagine often barriers and concerns for patients will come up. I just wanted to get your take on how you manage those barriers and concerns during the consultation.
Yeah, I think the way you start the conversation will influence what comes up and when it comes up. So resistance, let's say, is an emergent phenomena. The more you try and argue with a patient, persuade them and jump in with advice, the more likely you may come up with barriers and defensiveness. So it's important at the outset to kind of set the scene and emphasize autonomy. So you might say something like, now, just to let you know, I'm not here to tell you what to do. I'd like to get a good understanding of your thoughts about physical activity, you know, your understanding of how it might be helpful. Maybe we could explore options, but you're the decision maker, not me. So emphasizing autonomy at the outset can be helpful in reducing certain barriers and resistances in the conversations. But understandably, people who haven't been more active and have one or more long-term conditions may have concerns. And I think it's just important to surface those and explore them. But first of all, find out what they are. And then you might, you know, introduce some corrective information. You know, someone, let's say, has angina, may be understandably quite worried that they might have a heart attack. And so, you know, when you've surfaced a particular concern like that, then you might say, well, actually, can I share with you what we now know? That actually, well-controlled exercise can actually make angina go away over time, because as your heart and cardiovascular system improves, you'll find you can do a particular amount of physical activity without bringing on the angina symptoms. And then you say, what do you make of what I've just said? So when you surface barriers and concerns and demonstrate you've heard them with empathic listening, then you might provide some corrective information. And we know that physical activity is one of the most important things lots of people with long-term conditions can do. But we also know that they need some reassurance too.
Are there other things during the consultation that you might pick up on that can actually help facilitate people being more active?
It's not specific to physical activity, but one of the nice things about motivational interviewing is in all the noise of a conversation, there's a signal. Now, you can't see motivation, but what you can notice is behaviour. And in all the noise of the conversation, there are what we call utterances, or the things people say which indicate an interest in readiness, ability to change. And we call that change talk. And there are different types of change talk. So the acronym Darn Cats has been developed. So D is desire. And this would sound like a patient saying, what I'd like to, I want to, I wish I could. A in Darn is ability. Well, I used to be able to, I could, I have done. R are reasons. Well, it will help me lose weight, I'd feel better, I'd have better sleep, I'd have more energy. N language is need. I really ought to, I've got to, I should, I must. And so you're listening for those kind of, well, you're structuring the conversation in a way to increase the probability that change talk emerges, and then you're trying to strengthen it. And then in the terms of the cat, C is commitment language. I will, I'm going to, also known as behavioral intent. A is activation, I'm ready to. And TS is taking steps. Well, I've already kind of been down to the leisure centre and bought myself some trainers. And so partly what you're doing in MI is creating the right relationship to give people the opportunity to think for themselves. So you're really de-emphasising hierarchy. You don't want to trigger any reactance or defensiveness. And then you ask friendly, non-judgmental, open-ended questions. Hopefully they come up with arguments in favour of change. And then you might ask for elaboration. So let's say they said, well, I suppose, you know, I could go for a cycle with my daughter. And you might say, well, where would you go? And what would that be like for you, cycling with your daughter? And so what you're trying to do is they come up with the reasons, and then you use curiosity and Socratic questioning to try to strengthen their motivation. So, being able to elicit change talk, notice it when it occurs, and then gently strengthen it as the conversation progresses. And this is one of the ways in which we think motivational interviewing is helpful.
Say someone has decided that they want to become more active. How can we increase the chances that they both will become more active, and then when they've become more active, actually stay active as well?
Yeah, thanks. That's another great question. I think this is where we're talking about the transition to planning. So hopefully, if you've spoken with them and you've evoked their reasons why and you've built their confidence, that then they've got some kind of idea as to what would be helpful, and you might have shared with them some tips. But it's important at this stage to stay in evoke mode rather than roll your sleeves up and fall into the expert trap of telling them how much to do and when to do it. Stay in evoke mode and use questions like, you know, how would you get started? What's the easiest thing you could do? You know, how often do you think you might be able to do that? and other questions like, and let's say you manage to do that for 3 to 4 weeks, what do you think you might notice? So at this stage, you're trying to strengthen commitment. And as you say, help them develop a plan that increases the chances they'll stick with it. We know from the work, well, BJ Fogg has written a book, Tiny Habits, which is well worth a read. And a lot of people fail to make a behavior change or lose weight, for instance, because they make the amount of change they take on too big. So when they're motivated, they think they can walk, you know, for 30 minutes, 4 or 5 times a week. But then the motivation falls as it does, and then they may drop out or do less, and then they may kind of go back or relapse. So you want to help the person take small steps, see if they can become habitual, and also see if you can find something that they enjoy doing. Because, you know, we actually, if there's a difference between, motivation doesn't just vary in amount, it also varies in type. So intrinsic motivation is the motivation that comes from, you know, the actual joy of doing the behavior. Extrinsic motivation is motivation that comes, or reinforcement that comes from after the behavior has been done. So I enjoy going to the gym. It's intrinsically motivating. I enjoy kind of, you know, lifting weights and doing stuff. But also, am I extrinsically motivated as well? Or I have extrinsic motivation for going to the gym because of what comes after. You know, it's me stay in better physical shape and maybe have less pain, etc. I don't enjoy running, so I'm not intrinsically motivated to run. I will run once or twice a week, maybe, but it's more for what the benefits are that comes after the event. So to maximise the chances that someone becomes more active and keeps it up, try to see if you can find something that's intrinsically motivating for them that they enjoy doing. Have them come up with the ideas. Make it as easy as possible. If you can get them to schedule it at a particular time of the day, or, you know, so here are the other behaviour change techniques like scheduling and relapse prevention. So you might ask some questions like, what might get in the way of your plan? And how could you find a way around that? And who could help you be successful? And the good news is all these techniques we're going to chat shortly, I'm sure, are available if you want to get better at using different techniques to help with building readiness and confidence about change, and different open-ended questions and techniques to strengthen the quality of a plan.
So, Tim, is there anything else that we could consider to be helpful when thinking about personalised planning?
And the person might come up with them spontaneously, but you could offer them. So, for instance, self-monitoring can be helpful. And of course, there's a number of apps people can use to count steps and physical activity. So you could suggest, or they might suggest, self-monitoring. Having goals can be helpful. You don't want to necessarily rush into goal setting, but you might help them think about, you know, it could be an outcome goal like fitness, so it could be a behavior goal like how many times they're going to do something. So goal setting can be helpful, and of course having a follow-up conversation can also be quite helpful. So it might be you could even say, now some people find it helpful to have a little follow-up chat. Is that something you'd be interested in? So there's a range of different behavior techniques, thanks for asking me, that can also be helpful in strengthening commitment and increasing the probability someone stays physically active once they've started.
Brilliant. And I think just to kind of put these things into context, I just wanted to run you through a couple of cases, Tim, as well. So the first one, I just want to imagine that you're a GP in a GP surgery, and you see a 63-year-old man, James. He's a painter decorator. He's got a history of high blood pressure. He's had a heart attack 5 years ago, and he was recently diagnosed with diabetes. And he's come to see you to talk about his medication. And he's also taking some medication for depression. You know him pretty well, but you haven't spoken about physical activity in the past. How would you approach this patient, and what would be your key priorities with him?
I think a key priority is maintaining, hopefully, a good relationship. And getting engagement in the conversation. But if I wanted to raise the subject of physical activity, I'd like them to come out with the words first. So I might use a question like, what was his name? James, was it? Yeah. I might say, James, I'm just wondering, in addition to the stuff we're doing and the medication and that, What are your thoughts about other things which might, you know, help control your diabetes and reduce you having another heart attack and might even help with your depression? What are your thoughts? So I'd like to ask an open-ended question. It may not be that convoluted as the one I just gave, to see if he might say, well, I suppose, you know. So who knows what he'll say? But if he doesn't mention physical activity, then I might say, can I share with you something that a lot of my other patients find really helpful and the research suggests can be really effective? Hopefully they say yes when you say, can I share? You say, well, it's becoming more active. So if you can find a way to move more, and we could talk about how much, how you might do it, I'm reasonably confident that will have an impact on your diabetes and your mood and reduce your risk of having another heart attack. And then you'd say, what do you make of what I've just said? And he might say, oh, that's interesting, tell me more. And then he might signpost or make him aware of an exercise referral program. Or he might say, no, no, that's not for me, I'm too old for all of that nonsense. In which case, you know, you just move on. So, but what you've done is you've given quality information so he's come to an informed decision. What he decides is up to him, and that's respecting patient autonomy. And that's this principle of acceptance in MI. But at least you've given him the information and has decided at the moment not to act on it. So I wouldn't then start to badger and nag and try to persuade. And it may be that just raising the awareness in that conversation, even though he decides not to act on it, might actually bring forward the moment when he, you know, he might go away and think about it and he might come back in the future. So remember, the process is going on. The most important process is the decision process that's going on inside the patient's head. And what you're trying to do is to create the right conditions for them to think about and hopefully physical activity becomes more important in their own mind and they become more confident they could be successful. But the more you push, the more they may back off. So raise awareness, share information in a non-judgmental way. Don't say, and a lot of clinicians find the ask, share, ask sequence really helpful. What do you know about something that might improve your health? Can I share with you a couple more things? Only share 2 to 3 bullet points worth of information and say, what do you make of what I've just said? And a lot of people really find that a nice way to share good quality information without triggering defensiveness.
Great. That's a great way of just opening things up and providing an opportunity to think about physical activity. And then just thinking about a slightly different case. So imagine you're, again, in a GP practice, maybe you're a nurse doing a health check, and you see a patient called Sarah. She's a 45-year-old accountant. She's concerned as her father recently had a heart attack at the age of 68, and her grandmother died at the age of 52 from a heart attack as well. She's keen to do everything she can to try and prevent her getting heart disease. She is generally fit and healthy, has got normal blood pressure and BMI, and she lives at home with her 2 children and husband, and she used to enjoy cycling and football, but has stopped since she had children. What are your key priorities with this patient? Or is there a different approach you might use?
So there's a lot of reasons why she might want to become more active. She has become more active in the past. I still might use the same approach. You know, what's your understanding of things you might do to, you know, reduce your risk of X, Y, and Z? So I still might ask a nice open-ended question to see if she comes out with, physical activity as an option. Or I could. There's a couple of other techniques. So again, the importance and confidence scaling question is a nice, soft, exploratory approach. So you could say, I'm just wondering, on a scale of 0 to 10, how important is it for you to make, you know, regular physical activity part of your day or your week, where 0 is not at all important, 10 is very important, and see what she comes out with. And that can then initiate a nice person-centered approach, evoking from her own reasons for becoming more active. And then you might make the transition to exploring her confidence as well. So, you know, she may be more ready. Adopt this person-centered, non-judgmental approach, sharing information, but it's this evoking that's absolutely key. It's trying to draw out from her own reasons. And one of the nice things about MI is that this isn't a gaps model. This isn't this person's broken and they need fixing. This is the view is people are stuck and they've probably got the resources within them to move forwards in a healthy direction. and your job as a practitioner, which can be challenging because you need to move from a clinical mindset to a coaching mindset and sometimes back and forwards in the same conversation. But your job here is to create the relationship and draw out from them their own reasons for changing and their own ideas about how. So it's very much a solution-focused, strength-based approach to coaching, but trying to tap into and strengthen the resources that are already within the patient.
And Tim, I know you've trained a lot of clinicians in the past around motivational interviewing. Are there any specific challenges that they face when learning MI?
It's important. It's commonly important for it to be experiential because when they're on the receiving end of conversations in co-coaching and practice, they get the difference between being told what to do and being asked and open-ended questions. But something which clinicians commonly, they have a very strong writing reflex. They want to jump in and fix, understandably, because a clinician, someone comes into A&E, you know, with an earache or a nosebleed and dizziness, they want to find, you know, you want to find out and they want to find out what the matter is and what they need to do about it. So there's a diagnose and fix mindset. But in MI and behavior change coaching, telling people what to do gets in the way. So this transition to just evoking and drawing out from the person and not rushing in, try to fix. So that we call that resisting the writing reflex. So the writing reflex is this desire to fix, which is fine. But in MI, you want to notice your desire to fix and hold back. So in a way, the patient fixes themselves. But the other thing is people often struggle with just the empathic listening, just the ah of awes, the reflections. And even when, you know, I've demonstrated and we've looked at examples and we're setting up a practice to get people just to reflect back, to say something back to the person using a different form of words, rephrase or paraphrase or even a metaphor, but without any change in you know, meaning or even trying to get the person to understand a bit more deeply how they may be thinking or feeling, they really struggle with just the empathic reflections. And what comes out of their mouth is commonly a question, and often they can't help it. So I think there's a nice learning curve people on this, you know, people listening may have heard of. There's unconscious incompetence where you're rubbish and you don't know it. There's conscious incompetence where you're rubbish and you know it. There's conscious competence when you can do it if you really try. And then there's unconscious competence where it's just in your bones. And you'll know this from your clinical training, you know, with various skills. There are times when you know you're rubbish at something and you keep doing it and you keep doing it and you keep doing it until you can do it. And then it becomes automatic. And the nice thing about MI is you can get better at it, including empathic listening, but it's deliberate practice with feedback. Just the same if you're learning to dance or learning a musical instrument or learning to play sport. It's deliberate practice with feedback which makes the biggest difference to skill acquisition.
Brilliant. And I think, you know, you've mentioned a few resources and things throughout the conversation, but are there any, just closing off the conversation now really, are there any kind of top tips or resources that you'd point people towards who are inspired to go and improve their motivational interviewing skills?
Yeah, fantastic book. Guildford Press published the kind of series in motivational interviewing, but the motivational interviewing in healthcare is in the second edition. Fantastic paperback, about 10 quid. So that's not specific to physical activity, but that's a great book, motivational interviewing in healthcare. And then also the Active Conversations course, which you can learn about on the Moving Medicine website, will go into some of the things we've talked about today, Will, in a bit more depth. And also you get demonstrations and worksheets and tips, and you're encouraged to do this thing, deliberate practice, and there's a bit of moderation as well. So we've designed the course to help clinicians get better at, you know, brief interventions and MI-based coaching for physical activity.
Brilliant. And we'll put those in the show notes to the podcast. I think we will close it there. So thank you very much for coming to speak to me today, Tim. It's been a really interesting conversation.
And my pleasure.
Thank you.
And thank you all for listening. I hope you all have a physically active day. If you'd like to get more involved in the Physical Activity Clinical Champions program, or PAC program, then please do get in touch with us. It's an exciting program based in England, and the email address to get in touch with us is pacc@shu.ac.uk.